This is Book Public from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode, I talked to Lisa Coppolo about her story collection, Have Mercy on Us. Lisa Coppolo has lived a lot of lives. She's lived in many places all over the world and worked as everything from a paparazzi photographer to a script doctor. And in her stories, her characters make homes in far-flung places in myriad occupations. There are husbands and wives, grandparents and children in these stories. There are many common threads running through them that show that no matter where we are or who we are, we all suffer similarly. We want the same things. We love in ways that are wholly singular, but that are nothing if not a beautiful commonality shared the world over. There's a lot about love in these stories, but love isn't just a romantic element here, nor is it simply sentimental or a means to an end, a way to find a mate or a spouse. Never just that. Love here takes many forms, and it's such a complicated thing that the idea of mercy from the book's title, from an eponymous story in the collection, and from a Chekhov story the author admires, is really another word for love. If we consider all the meanings and types of love there are, just think about all the permutations of mercy. The flaws and follies of Coppolo's characters teach us something, too, about what it means to be human when we make mistakes or when we allow each other mercy. I spoke to Lisa Coppolo about her story collection, Have Mercy on Us. Well, Lisa, your book is Have Mercy on Us, and it's a collection of stories. It's your first book, and we're going to dig into some of the stories, but I'd really like to know how this came to be a collection, because I know you're a story writer and you've published stories in many different places, but I wonder if you can talk about this process for creating this book. This really interests me, and I know it interests a lot of our listeners who are writers or who are aspiring writers. So can you talk about how it happened for you?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you, Yvette. This collection, I was writing stories and I was getting them published and I was raising my daughter and teaching. And, you know, it was like, oh, I have six stories and I've, you know, had a couple of them published. So, but this took me like many years. And at the same time, I had a novel that I was sent out that was getting a lot of, you know, interest. So it's sort of, as a writer, you're balancing your life, you're balancing this, and you're like, and then you wake up and you're like, oh, there's six, maybe there's seven. Oh, I have three that I've been working on. And so it started like that. And really, this collection took about 10 years, really, in terms of like putting everything together. I wasn't working exclusively on it. There was a contest at Regal House for the W.S. Porter Prize for short fiction. And I entered that thinking there was no way. And and I won that prize. So that was really exciting for me.
That was my next question, was about the W.S. Porter Prize for Story Collections. Congratulations, Lisa. That is amazing.
Thank you.
And well-deserved, I have to say. So how did it feel? How did it feel to learn this news? This was your first story collection. What was it like when you heard?
Well, it was so funny because I went to my husband, and you know, you get a lot of rejection. I had had stories published in really good places, Plowshares and things like that. So all of those things were, everything is a surprise as a writer. You have zero confidence ever. And I mean, I'm married to a writer who still has, you know, such huge insecurities, as we all do. So I remember it was during COVID, which made it even more exciting. And I was like, there were 10, you know, shortlisted to 10 writers and their collection. And I knew, you know, three or four of the writers. And I was like, oh my God, what a blessing. I'm at the bottom. You know, I was the last name and I thought I just got in there. I'm so excited. And then I remember Richard was brushing his teeth and I went in and I was like, it was January of 21 or, you know, somewhere in those 2 years. And I said, I won that thing. Like, I won that thing. Like, it was just there, you know, you just have no idea that it's good until, I mean, not good, but you know what I mean? That you're thinking, oh, somebody else will win it. And it's not that I don't feel unlucky. I've had a really lucky, adventurous life, but that really made a difference to me because, you know, as writers, you're always thinking, when can I call myself a writer? When can I say I'm a writer? You know, because you're teaching, you're doing, oh, I teach, oh, I this, you know, oh, I'm a mom and I'm doing this, this, and this. And I don't know if that did it for me, but it sure has been wonderful. And I got some really, really great, blurbs and was in the Times or review in the Times, which was really a thrill. So yeah, I'm very lucky.
I've followed all of the buzz about the book and read the review in the New York Times, by the way, and I've just been cheering you on. I just think it's amazing, but it's also well deserved. And it's so interesting to hear this kind of, insecurity or imposter syndrome that we feel no matter what happens, no matter what positive, incredible things happen. And I think it maybe this is just the lot of the writer.
Yeah, I think it is definitely the law of the writer. Also being a woman, also being married to a writer who's, I mean, he's the most encouraging person ever, but I think, and then we have so many writer friends. And but I think for me too, it was like, I'm the youngest of six kids. I'm always trying to keep up. I'm always trying to, even still, it's funny. I'm gonna be 55 and I'm like, oh, I hope my sister's going to be, I have all these older sisters, just always trying to get that approval. And then you finally wake up and you're like, you know what? It doesn't matter. And I'm just writing and I'm writing. And that's actually where the joy comes in, is the actual writing. If if you're writing in a day, you've done something worthy. And all the other stuff is kind of fluff,
Yeah.
And I really, as it's a practice, I'm working on another novel now that actually is from the first story in my collection, and I'm really, in it now. So now it's like, okay. And I think it's the practice, and it's also the, the maturity and the understanding that, yeah, I can keep up. Yeah.
I'm so excited that Felt and Left have the same letters is the seedbed for a novel that's coming. I can't wait. That's so good to know.
The novel is called Some Men, which is kind of really topical at the moment for me. And it's sort of the woman that comes in that short story, whose husband has this affair on her while they're in Greece, and they're older, they're in their 60s, and then they come back to Toronto. And the story or the novel is based on what happens when they come back. It's kind of been really fun to write because she doesn't leave him. Well, I shouldn't say anything more about it, but thank you.
Oh, I can't wait. Well, so you mentioned Greece and Toronto. According to your bio, you've been to many places. You've lived many places, many far-flung places, and you've done many different things in your life. You were a paparazzi photographer in London, an aid worker in Kenya, a script doctor in LA, and you've been a publicist, a literary publicist in Toronto, and I'm sure many other roles in many other places. Tell me how it is that you are now. You're based in California. You're a story writer. Maybe it was inevitable or something for someone who has experienced life in so many places and so many roles. Like, do you have a sense of how that this life that you've had informs the writing? Because your stories are in many different places too.
Yes. Yeah, I've been lucky to have that backdrop, and it informs the writing in a big way. I mean, now I see the world so s cyclical in cycles, and living in Kenya, I worked in an orphanage for a year and had a few stories set there, and I still think of those places. And now I'm in California. I have no stories set in California. It's interesting how they come into your mind. And for me, it's very much a person I met, or an image. I have a scene where there's the when I'm living in Kenya, I decided out that the at the orphanage, it was really horribly. The walls were dirty, everything was dirty and yucky, and I came from Canada, and so I thought one day, let's with the kids, let's paint the kitchen or the area where we ate, kind of thing. And I went down and got this paint at the hardware store, and painted it this light green celery color, and nobody cared. The kids, I spent all my after time doing it. They didn't. That wasn't their sensibility. And so that image of this kitchen, me in there, and these kids that I could have been, doing a million other things with them, that was important to me, but not them. So those kinds of images stay in my mind. And I remember I went back to my compound where I was living, and I just thought, okay, this is, I shouldn't be here. I don't know what I'm doing, But it was a real lesson, and a real it, that kind of eye-opening experience can only happen when you're in a different country. And to Travel is insight. You gain intelligence and understanding about the human heart in every way. So I've been very lucky that way.
It's so interesting to hear this anecdote because I think about the idea of compassion, the idea about care and concern, and your thoughtfulness about painting the walls that celery green, and then realizing that it didn't mean the same thing to those children that it meant to you. That same kind of compassion, that same kind of care and concern, a type of love is running through the stories in your book too. I mean, I think this is something that we see here, the idea of have mercy on us, the idea of mercy. And it's not a romantic thing. It's not a sentimental thing. It's never just that. So I'm glad you mentioned this idea of how the story can come to you. If you take a story like You're Here Now, or Teacups, or any of the stories in the collection, where does it usually begin? That was actually a question I had for you, and you said that it could be a person that you remember, it could be the wall or the kitchen. And I imagine that it varies depending on the story, but is there a way that the story arrives for you?
Oh, that's a good question. It usually arrives. It could be some dialogue. I write dialogue down a lot. Last night we walked to town for pizza, and there was a psychic set up behind us. And I was, had chatted with her, and I sat down because we were gonna have pizza, and I listened to her as people were walking by in our little town. And every person that walked by, she said, "You have beautiful energy. You have beautiful energy." And I thought, I love that. I'm going to use that in a story. And I was thinking about it when we were walking home. And so dialogue is a big thing for me. And then I, of course, wonder what this psychic's life is like. She said she was 31 and she's sitting in our town. And I'm thinking, well, where's, So I think it's like that. And then other ideas come to me, like You're Here Now is a story about a woman who goes to her father's funeral that she's never met. She has all these siblings, and she was raised by her mother. And that is a very personal story because I had a sister that my father fathered, who showed up at funeral, but not in the same way at all. But I imagine what this woman's life was like. And she was raised by one mother, and I was like, we had this big Italian Catholic, family, and I thought, wow, she showed up. And I mean, the story goes on, but it's not at all like You're Here Now, but that's where these ideas come from.
I love it. So there's just sort of adjacent, or there's just one little seed that then can take root in the story.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
think so.
Like you have beautiful energy. You have I can't wait to read that story when you write it.
Right. And I love it because it's a good thing because it makes you feel relaxed. And you're like, oh, I have beautiful energy. Maybe you need to give me a reading. It's great. Yeah.
Love it. Well, let me share something with you that Joy Williams wrote in the introduction to There Is Happiness, which is the posthumously published story collection by the late Brad Watson. She said this, and I was rereading that recently, and I knew I was going to talk to you, and I said, I'm going to ask Lisa about this. She said that the short story is, quote, an American treasure that American readers are so wary of, resisting its surprises, attentiveness, and demands. That's such a bummer. But I feel like there's some truth to it. What do you think about this? What's been your experience with this attitude or this idea?
It is interesting. It's what I love about short stories. It's an evening's entertainment from beginning to end. It could be 10 pages or 20 pages. It's the whole thing is there, and it's lost on people because, not lost, I shouldn't say that, but yeah, it's very much, oh, it's stories. I don't read very many stories. I should read stories. And so wary of the, it's interesting. I love that quote. And I think it's true. I think we, with characters, we like to hang on to them for a longer time. We like to, see what's in their kitchen, perhaps, or see what's, where they go to work. And we want the full fleshed everything. And It's like the you get the whole thing, and in a novel, everything, the textures, and then there's that line where it's just a short story comes at the side and just gives you a glimpse into the humanity. You don't maybe know about the mother or the past marriage or whatever. You get that one thing, which is I love it. And I think if readers tried short stories, they would just I think it's they would just be so much more open to it. So I think it's just the way that short story collections are portrayed,
Yeah.
But I love that quote. Thank you for sharing it.
Oh, you're so welcome. And I'm going to share another one with you in a minute. But first, I want to say this. I love this idea that even though I think a lot of us know that people have this attitude about short stories, we can't help but love them. Authors like you will continue to write them. It's like you can't not do it, even knowing that these attitudes exist out there. I love this idea. But I want to ask you about Fort Pierce, Florida. So here's a story that has its title, one of these many places that your characters get to inhabit. But for this story, we have Zora Neale Hurston inhabiting the story. What can you share with us about the story and how you were able to create this little world around a very real person?
Okay, so it sounds like I've had a cosmopolitan life and traveled a lot, and I have, but not in America. And when I got to do my MFA, it was my mid-30s, I was pregnant, and we were in Memphis, Tennessee, and I didn't know a lot about I didn't know literature. I mean, I didn't know, I hadn't read Faulkner. So everything that I did was Canadian or European based or Australia, like I had these. So I steeped myself in this culture of the South in learning. And I was at college in Memphis. It was the perfect place. And also, I was living it. I mean, I had come from Toronto, where, I lived in Little Portugal, and around the corner was Nigeria. There was like, every culture, it was amazing. And then I went to Memphis. The first class I taught, the black kids were on one side and the white kids were on the other. And I was like, what's going on? Like,
Oh.
where am I in so many ways? So it was my ignorance in a way that got me to really research. And then Zora Neale Hurston, I was fascinated by, and I had learned about her cleaning rooms in a motel room, near the end of her life. And it's actually funny because the professor that I had who taught me so much African American literature, and I was doing a minor in it, we had a paper to write, and I can't write papers to save my life, like a persuasive paper. I said, can I write a story instead? I'm like 9 months pregnant, and I have my brains, so I had started this story. And in the voice of Zora Neale Hurston, which in this culture I might not do, but at that time I thought, I just want to imagine what it might be have been like to be her cleaning rooms, being the scholar, and this guy who's from the South. Many of the kind of guys that at the time I had seen and very well off Southerner guy thinking he's a writer, and she cleans his room, and they have this conversation. And my friend Dancy Senna said she would love to make it into, see it as a little play. And I was like, oh my God, that would be so cool, because it's all just like the one room situation. But yeah, that's how that story came about.
I love this story so much. And I love
Thank
knowing
you.
the whole, I mean, I take the story just as it is with no other context, but I just love knowing this idea that you were so interested and I know you're a big Chekhov fan, and I know you're a fan of many other writers, but I love knowing that you immersed yourself in that space and you had so much going on. You were pregnant and working on, yeah, I think that's amazing. Well,
Well, it's to make sense of things, right? Because I'm in this new culture, and I'm thinking, what? So that's why we write these stories, and we're writers. We're trying to make sense of what we're living,
yeah, exactly. Well, let me give you this. This is a slightly more positive quote from Joy
Okay, great.
Williams. So she said this: "The good short story tells us something very alarming about ourselves and our puzzling sojourn on this earth, our situation, as it were. It is the perfect vehicle for delivering us to ourselves, an experience we instinctively wish very much to avoid." A good story gives us a glimpse, and the glimpse is so surprising, so varied, yet unequivocal, so ruthlessly complete that it does awaken us in some manner, if not protect or prepare us. And I have to say, when I reread that recently, knowing that I was going to speak with you, I thought about Have Mercy on Us. I thought about this idea about the perfect vehicle for delivering us to ourselves, even if it's an experience we, you know, we would want to avoid, but we don't. And the story gives us a glimpse that is so surprising, yet unequivocal. I just thought that's Lisa Coppola's stories.
Oh, thank you. Gosh, what a huge compliment. Ruthlessly complete. I loved that line in there. I mean, Kafka says it's a story is something to break the frozen sea within us. And I feel like that's it. We walk around being frozen a lot, and breaking that frozen sea, like that, what you just said is embodying that kind of, you know, getting to the core of us, the glimpse, the clarity. You know, that's why I love endings of short stories so much. It's like after you finish a story, it really is meant to just, oh, you take a break. You know, you still have those characters. That's why it's like, okay, read a story a night. That's how I try and do it. I mean, a lot of times I'm reading more than that, but it's lovely to have that moment of clarity at the end. And that really is what you're looking for. You're not looking to solve this person's life. You're looking for that cup of tea where she takes the tea and sits and have a moment of peace at the end. Or, you know, the door opens and a light or some. I do love the idea of some levity or hope at the end of a story without, like you said, not being sentimental, or, you know, it's some kind of truth about love. That is a brief glimpse, and that's what we get in life, brief glimpses, you know.
Yeah,
that's what we can hope for, is the glimpses and those moments of clarity.
You know, I really like that you've said this, because there's this thing about your stories, these characters are flawed. There, we say, as Frank O'Connor wrote, all stories are about loss, and you know, these characters are flawed, and the characters are flawed, but they teach us something. And I connect your stories to the Joy Williams quote for this reason, too, about what it means to be human when we make mistakes, mm-hmm. or when we allow each other mercy. So this, the mm-hmm. idea of mercy from the title is something that I really tried to think about when I was reading a story about a character that was doing something, you know, pretty terrible, or reacting to a character in a way that I found a little bit questionable, or that I wondered if I would do the same thing. But that measure mm-hmm. of mercy that is running through this, but you're right. I don't know if it's, maybe that's this hope, this glimpse of hope that you're talking about that isn't sentimental, as you say, that's very true, but it's the thing that maybe makes us human too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because we're always, you know, my mom said, well, you always look for the good in people, right? Find the good, because there's always bad, or at least, I mean, there in my life, I've, you know, things that you can see, like I have that kind of the father, say, in my story, Long Division, where he's this really self-centered guy, and he's almost 80, and he goes to Kenya to fetch his son, who's working in this AIDS orphanage, to say, hey, you need to come home because your sister's messed up and she's going, you know, she's going through depression. And you think, oh, what an idiot this guy is. He's going to, you know, and it's, you see all his flaws, but you're also rooting for him.
Yes.
And I think that, yeah, the hope is that you want to root for this, because yes, I don't want to see a perfect person. And I think that's what's so funny about how we present ourselves. It's so boring to be perfect. We're interested in characters who have grit and difference. And, you know, you show up at somebody's house and they do everything perfect for a dinner party. And you're like, oh, God, you go home and you're like, oh, no. But you go to somebody's house and the kitchen's a mess and they're laughing and somebody gets drunk. It's like, oh, that's great. Okay, I feel normal now. Yeah, so I think that's it's finding truths within us that is like, we all want to be loved. We're looking for love, and that's kind of the mercy. Have the mercy for the thing that is. Yes, this is an egotistical person, but look at this lovely thing, you know. I guess that's why I write. That's how I live, I guess.
Lisa Coppola, thank you so much. I'm so happy I got the chance to talk to you today. And congratulations on all of your success with the story collection. Oh, Have Mercy on Us.
It's been such a joy. Thank you, Yvette. I really, really have loved talking to you. This has been wonderful.
Lisa Coppola is the author of Have Mercy on Us. The book was a winner of the W.S. Porter Prize for Story Collections. This has been Book Public from Texas Public Radio. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.